Derek's going to read. We're going to do a 2-minute meditation. And then we are going to say the prayer.
So, you know, we're going to be starting the third step in this session. And I wanted to read this because as I read it earlier, it made me think of the third step. Make the mind a single point. The key to any consideration is to concentrate the mind into a single point around this consideration. There are many methods for doing this, from singing to listening to holy words to contemplative procedures, but the end result is the same. We focus our minds sharply on the decision ahead. A point has a definite position in space, but neither size nor shape. A point marks an actual place in time, such as a point of departure. A point is the very essence of something, as in the point of an idea. A point is a coordinate for navigation. A point is the dominant center, as in the principal point of perspective. A point determines our outlook, as in point of view. Once the mind is made up to a single point or a decision, it takes on the above attributes. In contrast, a mind that is not focused is dispersed over a wide area. Its thoughts are scattered, its energies are in disarray, and it cannot move clearly in any direction. It is at the mercy of 1,000 influences and is easily disoriented. The result is confusion, ignorance, unhappiness, and helplessness. A mind that is clearly focused, however, receives all the things it can abide in utter tranquility. It is no exaggeration to say that its world revolves around it. It no longer has to chase after all that appears before it.
Meditation. Prayer.
God, please lay aside everything I think I know about this weekend. The big book, alcoholism, addiction, the 12 steps, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience. Help me see the truth. Amen.
So as we approach this third step, we're going to divide the third step up into four parts, but the reading before the meditation was talking about focus on a point. The decision in the third step is where we need to focus our energies right now, and I look at the third step as you're entering into a contract with the power you call God. And like most contracts, there is responsibilities on either end of the contract, and then there are terms and conditions. So to me, as I read that, it seems as if at times I forget what decision I've made in the third step. And the way I can quickly see when I've deviated from the decision is when I'm doing things in my life with very little consideration. I don't seek counsel. They tend to fall under the category of defects of character. I know I can't do any different because I'm lacking power in my life, and that's why I'm being compelled to move in these directions. But the way to recalibrate or what corrective measures I put into my life is when I go back to this third step. So I know a lot of people rework the steps and they start at step four, and I was like, what the? I mean, the whole foundation is built on the first three steps. I've always got a current unmanageability to look at. It's always there in some way, shape, or form. I've got current unmanageability. In some way, shape, or form, I've got some prejudice against God. I've got some doubtful and negative ideas going on internally around God. I get indignant with God from time to time, which makes me have to look at my third step decision again. Are the actions in my life supporting the decision I made in the third step that God's going to direct and I'm going to act, that I'm empowered to have an agency for God and He's the principal, that He takes care of me like a father takes care of a child, and that He's my employer and I work for God? This is the contract. And so I have to ask myself, are the actions I'm engaging in my life supporting this contract? It's just something to work with. It's an interesting place to be, though, because at times I do things that would contradict the contract, but I also know it's God that's sending me into those experiences. Because I have those experiences for a specific reason, because I need to grow in some area of my life. I need to see something that I've never seen before. So you begin to live in this crazy both worlds of, yes, I have no choice and I'm going down this path, but I'm also have to reflect on the decision because I need to engage the relationship with God. But because I live in both worlds where I'm trying to engage a relationship with God, but at the same time I know it's God that's moving me into these very experiences, it makes for a fun experience with my God. And, you know, I know a lot of people in my situation, having lost what I've lost, my father, you know, the ability to see my daughter on a day-to-day basis, not, you know, wife is gone, house is gone, a lot of other things have been changing in my life, a lot of other struggles. They might get resentful at God, and there have been times where I have said some profanity towards God. Enough is enough, you know. Please let up. You know, I can't take anymore. But through those experiences, I was stripped of more of the worldly clamors that I think I have to have in my life in order to have some type of identity, and I just have one real relationship. Everything else stems from that relationship, is my relationship with God. Every relationship in my life, I believe, is a direct reflection of the relationship I have with God and myself. So, you know, I have guys that tell me, they'll call me up and they've got some stuff going on in their relationships. And sometimes I don't really know what advice to give them or what suggestions to give them, but I'll ask them about their relationship with God. That relationship is right, all their other relationships are going to look like they're supposed to look. That means we do have enemies at times. I'm not supposed to like everybody. There are a lot of people I don't like. I don't care to spend time with them. It's okay. There are a lot of people that don't like me. There's probably somebody in here that doesn't like me right now, and that's totally cool. I'm okay with that. Because if everybody likes you, you're a phony. If everybody likes you, you're a phony. And so the third step is it's sort of when we start to go down the rabbit's hole, as if we haven't already gone down the rabbit's hole. And so let's turn to page 58. I just want to point out one sentence on this page because we're going to move rather quickly through this. You know how it works, opens up with, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. You know what that should say?
Never.
Rarely have we seen a person follow our path. Because that's the reality of it. Very few people in the rooms follow the path. Hunter brought up one of our myths. If you hang out at the barbershop, you're going to get a haircut. Do you guys think more people stay sober? Or what percentage of the people that go to meetings, do you actually think are actually getting sober?
25%.
So if you hang out at the meetings, does that mean you're going to relapse? Based on the logic of the barbershop, it does. Because everybody at the barber, majority of people at barbershops get haircuts. The majority of people at meetings relapse. Wow. You like that one?
I was like, wait, your logic's like, that's a straight logic. So 75% of the people that go to meetings end up drunk or high. So I'm hanging out at the wrong places. I need to stay away from the people and the places and the things that lead me to drink.
Okay, how about how most people who aren't in a meeting are going to be using? So if you got 25%, it's a better place to be in a meeting than not in a meeting.
I'm not going to argue with that.
Logic doesn't make sense.
I don't know. 90% of the population doesn't have a problem with drugs or alcohol.
Only
so I'm
going to
go with the percentage that's less.
Okay, and what the barbershop thing has to do with is hanging around people that are actively using.
Yeah.
That's the barbershop.
If I'm spiritually fit, I don't really want to do that.
And not everybody's spiritually fit, so it's still safer for them to be in a meeting until they become spiritually fit than to be hanging around people who are still using.
I can get down with that.
What we're trying to show this crowd here is that you cannot stay sober off a slogan.
Right. You stay sober off of becoming spiritually fit.
Right.
Yes.
I totally agree with that.
So, does everybody understand? Yes?
Yes, sir.
Because there's times that I go to the barbershop just to get the beard trimmed.
Nice.
And there's times that I get the hair and the beard. Sometimes I do the beard myself.
So let's turn. So when I'm taking a guy through the steps, I'm going to divide.
We're going to pause real quick on top of 59, right before they give the short form of the steps. We didn't touch on this in the forewords, but it says in the foreword of the second edition that the steps that outline the program of recovery have been translated into many different languages. Right before the short form of the steps here, they said, here are the steps that we took which are suggested as the program of recovery. Now, one of the things that I hear misquoted constantly in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous is that they say that when a person's coming to a meeting, they're in the program. The program is the steps. I don't know if you're in the program or if you're not in the program. I can tell you Tarek is because he and I communicate regularly. I can tell you the guys that I sponsor are in the program. But I don't know that somebody that's sitting in the same meeting as me, I don't know if they're in the program. They're in the fellowship.
Yes, there is a difference.
But I don't know that they're in the program. And we throw around this, oh, he's in the program, oh, he's in the program, he's in the program. You can't know that. You can know it for some, but not all. The steps are the program. Let's be real clear on that one.
So page 60. It says halfway down the page, our description of the addict or alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that I am an addict and alcoholic and I cannot manage my life. B, that probably no human power can relieve me of my addiction and or alcoholism, and C, that God can and will if I seek. So when I'm sponsoring a guy, at this point, I'm going to push the big book away from me. This is a little thing I do. And I'm going to ask the guy I'm sponsoring to convince me of A, B, and C based out of what we've done in the book so far and his experience. Why go any further? Because look at the next paragraph. It says, being convinced, we are at step three. Now, the original manuscript of Alcoholics Anonymous used to say, if you're not convinced of these three vital ideas, you ought to reread the book up to this point or else throw it away. That's what the original manuscript said. And they knew they had to soften it up because they knew they'd get some knuckleheads. And so they did. So A, B, and C, out of your own experience, why am I alcoholic? Simple. When I drink, I cannot control the amount that I drink the majority of the time. Not every time, but most of the time. And then I stop drinking, and no matter how great my necessity, the necessity or my wish not to pick up the first drink, somehow I find myself picking up another drink. So that's why I'm alcoholic. And the same thing applies with drugs for me. And I can't manage my own life because the further I got away from my last drink, I realized that I existed in a... My internal condition was such that I needed an effect produced at all times. All times I need an effect produced, otherwise I cannot be still. And I didn't discover that until I was a year and a half clean and sober when I hit bottom with the second half of the first step, which is unmanageability. I had no obsession to get high. I had no obsession to drink, and my life was completely unmanageable. So I made the connection that my alcoholism and addiction, the drugs and the alcohol, were not why my life was unmanageable. There was a deeper unmanageability that had to be addressed. And that God can and will. So I never waver on the belief that God can do everything. What I question is, will he? That's where I struggle at times, is will he? So once I have a discussion with the gentleman I'm taking through the steps about A, B, and C, and I'm convinced, then we're at step three, which is that we're going to make a decision. That's what that says. We're going to decide to turn our will and our life over to God as we understand him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? That question is answered at the bottom of page 62. So, there's a requirement. So this is the second part of the third step. The first requirement is that Tarek be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And here's my definition of self-will. Tarek does what Tarek wants to do when Tarek wants to do it with total disregard of the ripple effect of what Tarek is about to do. That is self-will. Okay, and I see it in the men that come through my program on a regular basis. I can see it in some of the conversations I've had this weekend. That is the core problem. It's not the drugs and the alcohol. It's doing what you want to do when you want to do it, and you don't care who it's going to affect. That's the core problem of addiction. It was my core problem the majority of my life leading into when I first picked up drugs and alcohol. And so if I don't fulfill this requirement, the third step's not going to make any sense to me because they use terminology that indicates this problem. I'm always in collision with something or somebody. Who knows what that's like? To always be button heads. Yeah. Everybody knows what it's like to be button heads on a regular basis. That's part of living in self-will. To live by self-propulsion. Like a pinball in a pinball machine, just bouncing from one thing to the other. You never come up for air. You just go, 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 go. There's no self-reflection. There's no self-examination. Full steam ahead. And then we're like actors that want to run the whole show. You know, it's like I sit on my throne, right? Let's imagine I'm up on a stage, and this is my throne up here. And you are all symbols of the important people in my life. And I have this box of scripts. Right, I'm the director, I'm the producer, I'm the light guy, I'm also the sound guy. So, check it out. I've got a script for you. And the script tells you how you need to act in my life. And I go out into my week or my day, and I communicate with you as if I sent you the script. But here's the deal. I never sent you the script. That's how we treat people. We treat people as if they need to know exactly what to do when we're around and how to act. Why? Because I want my life to be easier. Anytime I want someone else to be different, it's because I want it to make my life easier. I call that self-seeking. And then they go through this piece where they're describing what we do. And then they get to the middle of page 61, and it's one of my favorite statements in the book. So what is Tarek's basic trouble? This is seven lines down in that middle paragraph. Is Tarek not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is Tarek not a victim of the delusion that he can violently twist or pull away, that's what rest means, satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players in Tarek's little play that these are the things that Tarek wants? And do not Tarek's actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Tarek, even in his best moments, is a producer of confusion rather than harmony. I used to love telling people I didn't like drama, but I was always at the center of the drama.
Yeah.
It's funny how that works. Turn to page 62. So look, the authors of the big book are absolutely ingenious. What do you think would have happened if you guys opened up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 1, and page 1 in big bold letters said, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of your problem? Do you think he would have stayed? I needed some talk about alcohol and drugs first. To see my hopelessness, to see the hopelessness of the addiction and the alcoholism. And once I saw how hopeless I was, then this stuff about God and self-will run riot would start to maybe sink in a little bit more, because I see how hopeless I truly am. So they wait until page 62 to tell you the truth. They don't tell you the truth on page 1. So selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of Tarek's trouble. Driven. Anybody know has anyone ever looked up the word driven in the dictionary? One of the definitions is to be compelled or moved by another force. So Tarek is compelled or moved by another force that comes in the forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Tarek steps on the toes of his friends and family, and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt Tarek, seemingly without provocation, meaning Tarek throws his hands up and says, "What'd I do?" This made me think of McNulty in The Wire. What'd I do? But invariably, that means always, Tarek finds that at some time in the past, Tarek made a decision based on self, a selfish decision based on ego, which has now placed him in a position to be hurt. Does that sound like you reap what you sow?
Yes.
Yeah. It also sounds like what goes around comes around. It also sounds like karmic retribution. Any way you look at it, that's what that paragraph just laid out. So now this next sentence, I'm here to tell you, you're about to receive the best news you've ever received in your entire life. You ready for it? So your troubles are basically of your own making. They arise out of yourself, and we are extreme examples of self-run riot, though we usually don't think so. Anybody want to take a stab at why that is the greatest statement of hope you've ever received?
It is only you have to change.
Yeah. Yeah.
Makes yourself aware of the problem.
Well, Chris, say that again.
It's only you have to change. The other people don't have to change for you to be all right.
Yes. The world and the people in it do not have to change for us to be free. If my troubles are of your own making, I'm screwed. Because I don't get free unless you come back and tell me you're sorry.
It's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. If you live that way in your life, you will never be a victim again. You will never be a victim again. Above everything, Tarek must be rid of this selfishness. He must, or it will kill him, so they threaten my life. God makes that possible. Tarek can't make that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without God's aid. Tarek's had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but he can't live up to them even though he wants to.
Do the next right thing?
Oh, that's a good one. And neither can he reduce his self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on his own power. He has to have God's help. So interesting. They just told you that your selfishness has the power to kill you, and then they tell you you can't do anything about it. All you can do is seek God's help.
Damn it.
Interesting. So now we get into the third part of the third step, which is the decision. It's the contract. So this is when they answer the question on the previous page. This is the how and the why of it, Tarek. You've got to quit playing God. Why? Because it doesn't work. So next, you're going to make a decision that hereafter in this drama of life, that God's going to be the director and you're going to be the actor. That God's going to be the principal and you're going to be his agent. That God is the father and you are the child. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept is the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. That's the third step decision. So when I'm taking a guy through the steps, he's going to define those words using a dictionary, and then he's going to write a prayer that's the decision. So he's going to write his third step decision in a prayer form. And so what he's doing, he's beginning to cultivate and nurture this relationship with God. And then we affirm everything with the third step prayer. Okay?
So we go to all these meetings, mostly AA meetings, and they read the promises. Okay? And they have become so entrenched in AA lore that I had a buddy that was going through treatment, and his treatment professional told him that those were the AA promises. And he said, well, actually, those are the ninth step promises. And she says, no, they're AA's promises. When you work AA steps, these are the promises that come true. And he's like, no, those are the steps that come, those are the promises that come through true as a result of the ninth step promises. And her comment was, I've gone to school for this. I know what I'm talking about.
She must have had a master's.
She didn't mean any harm, but guys, there are some promises right here that are some of AA's promises that are associated with the third step that are pretty freaking cool. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept him close and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. That's some pretty promising shit, isn't it? Okay.
How does everyone feel about taking a moment of silence and all reading the third step prayer together? Cool? Okay. Prayer.
God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I have helped of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always.
Notice it doesn't close with amen. Notice that if you really dissect that prayer, it's not about you at all. So I'm offering myself to you in these non-real formal English words that they use to build with me and do whatever you want with me, right? Relieve me of me so that I can do what you want. Take away my difficulties, not for me, but so that when they're gone, I get to go out and tell other people that you did it. That's my translation. Short form, my life is no longer my job. It's about others. I wonder how many people have missed the purpose of the prayer. I wonder how many people say the prayer on a daily basis and have no idea what it says. Wonder why there's no amen. I'll explain why I believe there's no amen. I'll explain it now. Turn to page 76. That second paragraph on page 76, there's the seventh step prayer. I'm not going to read it all, but if you notice, it finishes with amen. Now, I know that prayers start, and then when the prayer's over, you know it's over because you say amen. This is where the amen exists in the book. And over on 63, there's no amen. So that, is it possible, just for consideration, that everything that I do from page 63 all the way to page 76 is one continuous prayer? Is it possible that that includes all of the fourth step, all three inventories, all of the fifth step, and all of the sixth step? And that that entire thing that I'm working on is a sacred act? Is it possible? I don't know. I like to think so.
Is it pig and chicken time? No.
Yeah, it is.
How many, anybody here think you actually have the power to make that decision? But I'll tell you what, guys, this is just my own personal experience. If I had the power to make that decision, my big book would have been one page long. It would have said, God gets you sober, keeps you sober, have a nice day. Because I would have made my decision and been on my way. I would have sprouted some wings and a little halo, and I'd float away.
Well, and I also think it's kind of, I love the third step prayer because it's like, so let's say, you know, God's hanging out with his buddy somewhere up there, right? And Bill's flushing out the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he gets to the third step. And Bill's like, okay, we're going to have this prayer where we decide that we're going to turn our will and our life over to the care of this God, right? And God's sitting there going, seriously? Seriously. Like, I couldn't, like, control your life and do everything, anything I wanted with it anyways? That's fine. We'll give you the prayer to make you think you're actually doing something. Because that's kind of how my God is, and he's kind of a funny kind of guy that's like, okay, whatever. You can say the prayer, but I already have complete control over your life anyways. But just so you can feel like you're doing something, I'll let you do this third step. That's, isn't it cute?
You guys ever wonder why when people are terminally ill, they have to get their last will and testament together? You ever thought about why they call it a last will and testament? Let's say you're about to... you have $1 million you need to disperse amongst your heirs, and you start divvying it up, and Joe gets this amount, and Sally gets this amount, and Roger gets this amount. What are you doing in that last analysis? Aren't you really passing your final judgment on everyone in your life? And you're giving them their worth, right? You're judging them, and you're placing a monetary value on it. And so when this guy pointed this out, it really made sense to me because so much of my will in my life is based on my judgment. This is a room filled with some of the most judgmental people on this planet right now.
We feel it, don't worry.
Yeah. And us included. He and I are not excluded from that. This is one of the core problems of addiction and alcoholism is the constant judgment of others and ourselves. And so part of it is, you know, getting to a place where we can live a life with reduced amounts of judgment. Because I don't know if the judgment will ever truly be eradicated from my life. But a lot of my third step, it has to do with the judgment of others and myself being removed from my life. And I look, you know, guys that are in programs, like the majority of people sitting in this room, if you want a good example of self-will run riot, you know what it is? Is that you're in a program and you're constantly trying to manipulate the situations. You know, staff changes shifts. You go to one staff on one shift and ask for something and they say no. When the new shift comes in, you go and ask them the same question.
Yeah. Anybody ever do that with their parents?
Yeah.
Man. This is self. This is the core problem of addiction, right? Not submitting to a way other than your own and constantly fighting everything. This is some of the things we look for when we're examining how someone is doing. How much resistance is there? How much fight is there? Because the more resistance and the more fight, The further you are from surrender, the further you are from even entertaining the idea that you need God in your life to solve any of your problems, and the further you are from ever getting to a place where you can say, God, I offer myself to you. Because you're the be-all and the end-all, the alpha and the omega. That's the way I look at it. I was that guy. I was that guy for 3 years, in and out of these programs, refusing to look at anything that anyone suggested to me. Okay?
Brandon, question, comment. Going back to what you said real quick about God and Bill W. up there, saying, and you said something to the effect of, okay, so you think you, we're going to put this in here to give you the idea that you're actually doing something. That only, the way you described it, to me, I perceived it as that gets rid of our God-given free will. I'm just bringing
No, I hear you. And
be careful.
We would have to talk a really long time about what is free will.
That's fine. We can go over it later.
And I'm just... My perception of what that is changes on a regular basis.
Yes, sir.
And I have no ability to do anything right.
Sidebar.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to go so like out there deep in this hole that whatever I'm saying isn't going to make much sense to anybody.
That's
so
fine. I just wanted to bring it up.
Yeah,
it was in my head, so sorry.
I'll just say this. I don't believe that I have the ability in this moment to act any differently than I am right now.
Okay. I can ride with that.
So okay. I'll leave it at that, and
we'll talk later.
We can talk later.
Okay. Thanks.
So that completes the third step. Isn't it funny how they tell you not to make any major decisions in the first year of your recovery, but a few weeks in, maybe a month in, you're sitting down with a sponsor and you're making a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care and direction of God?
Oh my God, we were talking about that the other day.
No big deal.
We were talking about that the other day.
Not a big decision at all. So they make a couple of time references for when we should start our fourth step, and you guys get to pick which one, so I'm going to give you some leeway. The first word of the last paragraph on that page says next. When is next in time reference? Now, correct?
Yeah.
Immediately.
Next is now.
Okay.
So next, there's your first option. We launch out into a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision in the third step was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless, and here's the next time reference, at once, followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us from ourselves, from God, and from the people in our lives. Drugs and alcohol are but a symptom, so let's get down to causes and conditions. So the two time references are next and at once.
Which one do you want?
At once.
Okay, it's a joke. Why doesn't anybody ever
get it? Wait, they also said something that's kind of weird in there, guys.
I understand next.
They also say that it could have little permanent effect.
Little permanent.
So they think that it can have a permanent effect.
Yeah.
Weird, huh?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Who talks about turning it over and taking it back? Turn your will over and taking it back. Okay. I believe, and let your own experience play out for you, that we don't have the power to turn it over, otherwise we would. The only thing that makes me have the capacity to make this happen is I work steps 4 through 9. When I work steps 4 through 9, they contradict the way I've existed in my entire time in this body before working the steps for the first time. Not only that, but on a gut level, core, in my core, I don't want to do those. I don't want to do a personal house cleaning. On some level, I don't want to share all this stuff with another person. I don't want to go to God on my knees over and over with egg on my face. And I don't want to make all these amends. but I see the connection with death, and so I do it. That's how the decision happens. So people are like, well, how do I turn finances? Let's talk about relationships. How do I turn relationships over to God? This is how I think this plays out. I write inventory about some relationships that have some resentments. And then I fifth step that inventory around these relationships. And then as a result of fifth stepping the relationships, I discover I've got some grosser handicaps that in my character that are causing me to continually fail in my relationships. And then I go to God and I say, God, I can't do anything. I've been like this my whole life, and this stuff is really objectionable. And if it's time for it to be cast out, will you please cast it out? If I have to live with it, thy will be done. And then I have a list of people I've harmed because of that behavior, and then I go make the amends. Once you've done all that, in my book, you've now turned over relationships to God. But we have a lot of people out here in the meetings that talk about turning it over and taking it back as if it's something I can just do on a regular basis. Maybe when I'm here, like maybe when I celebrate like 25 years, they'll show me where the magic button is under the table, and when I push that button, I just instantly turn it over. I don't know. But that's the way I hear people talk. And they're really stuck on this third step. For me, the steps 4 through 9 make the decision happen. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. You want to go into inventory?
Yeah. So in the middle of the page, it says, first, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. What failure? Just every life. Okay. Being convinced that self manifested in its various ways was what had defeated me, I considered its common manifestations. Okay, so they're telling me that I'm going to look at it multiple ways. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics and addicts than anything, including drugs and alcohol. It actually says that it destroys more alcoholics than anything else, which must include drugs and alcohol, right? From resentment stem all forms of spiritual disease. Okay, so here they're starting to clue you in again that there's something else going on other than the mental and physical. Okay, we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. There, they just came right out and said it. So remember the guy that said that he had to get a job before he could actually really get into this? When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. The job is physical, okay? It's of the physical plane. So when I work the spiritual angle, it takes care of everything else. But what do most people do when they come here? They want to get the relationship right, get the job right, get all that stuff right. That'll give me a good feeling in my head, and then I'll focus on the spiritual.
I mean, think about it. Most of us, we want to treat our body. We go to the gym. We want to get on the organic food. We want to get all chiseled and ripped so the girls look at us. Or the girls want to, you know, they want to trim up and they want to, it's all about the body. That's the first thing the majority of people that come into these rooms treat is the body. They don't treat the spirit. And then we have the cross addictions that come to the surface. Okay? Go ahead.
You go through the explanation here. So then we break into resentment inventory.
Okay. So just real quick, Brandon pointed out a 3-part problem. A lot of people believe it's a 2-part problem because they think the majority of human beings on the planet are walking around with a spiritual malady, which is very true. But it's still part of our problem because if the spiritual malady is not treated, then the mental obsession returns. It's still got to be part of the problem. So I look at this as a 3-part problem, and I think the authors of the big book do too because they just listed out 3 parts. So in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We're going to list people, institutions, and principles with whom we are angry. We ask ourselves why we're angry. In most cases, we found that it's self-esteem, pocketbook, ambitions, personal relationships, including sex relationships, are hurt or threatened. So we're burned up. We're sore. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal and sex relations which had been interfered with. If you go down to the bottom of the example, next to my wife, if you go over to the third column, he's got the word pride there. So we're going to include that in our inventory. And so here's the inventory that I've learned how to write. It's the most effective. And let's look at Mr. Brown, who should have his ass kicked, by the way. Mr. Brown, right? Let's check Mr. Brown out. Mr. Brown is paying attention to Bill's wife. He told Bill's wife about his mistress, and he might get Bill's job at the office.
Son of a bitch.
Yes. Those are three pretty heinous things to be resentful at someone for, right? Would you agree? And Bill uses 19 words to describe that in the third in that column. And so this, when I give someone inventory, can you guys read this? Okay. Column one is, who are you angry with? People, institutions, and principles. Who's let you down? Because a lot of people have a difficult time with the word resentment. I mean, I have a lot of guys, several guys I've sponsored over the years who tried to tell me they didn't have any resentments, that they're forgiving people. They've forgiven everybody. So let's
work. Are you irritated with anybody? Are you annoyed by anybody?
Who do you gossip about? Whose character do you assassinate?
Who just pisses you off?
So that's column one. Column two. Why are you angry, let down? Why do you feel slighted? You can use only 19 words to describe this. In the Mr. Brown example, Bill uses 19 words to describe three things Mr. Brown did. They're big and bad things. Be definite, concise, and specific. So when a guy, I'm taking it through the steps right inventory, and then we get ready to do fifth step. He is not allowed to say anything other than what he wrote on the piece of paper. Why do I do that? Because the ego wants to pontificate. It wants to give me the backstory. What I say to them is like, if I want backstory, I'll ask you for the backstory. Mm. I just want to know what you wrote on the piece of paper. So I give them 19 words.
So what I have is this turd on this piece of paper that I'm getting ready to make you swallow, but I'm going to sell the hell out of it before I give it to you. That's what it really is.
And so when we're writing on a principle, we answer these questions as well. Where did you get this idea, belief, or way of thinking from? When operating by this code or value or principle, how do you show up in relationships with other people? So it has an effect on how we interact with people.
When you say show up, what do you mean?
How do I interact with people?
How do you present?
Like one of my self-defeating principles that I live by is that I am rarely wrong. Right? So what happens in my relationships with other people? Sometimes I run roughshod over people. I don't really listen. I'm just waiting so I can have my rebuttal ready. And other times, I don't understand you. You don't get the idea that I understand you. You know, I don't seek to understand first, then you'll understand me. I just seek to shove stuff down your throat. This has been a part of my struggle, and I am fully aware of it, and God has not changed that. It's gotten, every year it gets a little bit better, but on some level it's always been there. Okay? Just something I'm aware of. But I had to figure out where I got that value and code from. You know? Column three. So once I have column one and column two, I go to column three. And Brandon's going to read some inventory. Very current inventory. Column three. How are the seven areas of self hurt, threatened, or interfered with? So self-esteem. Self-esteem is like, think of every resentment in your life as one act in the play. Let's call your life a drama. And you've got, every day you have acts in your play that are spread out across the day, and you may end up with a resentment in that act in the play. And your self-esteem is, how do you see or feel about yourself in this one act in the play, drama of life? And it always starts out with the words, I am, right? So I have a resentment towards my mother, because my mother is always judgmental and condescending, and she likes to control everything, which is a true resentment that I've recently had. And then I would say, I am, and I'd probably write something about what kind of son I am.
Don't spend too much time on the example.
So pride is, how do you want others to see or feel about you? Ambition, what do you want as the outcome? Security, what do you require or need as an effect produced internally to be okay and live? Personal relationships, what are your deep-seated beliefs regarding how this relationship should look? Sex relations, what are your deep-seated beliefs about what the gender you're writing about should do or be in this situation? And pocketbook is, how's your wallet or your time affected? And then column four is fear, dishonesty, selfish, and self-seeking. And Brandon's going to read some inventory.
So So it's fun. I'll give you a tiny bit of backstory, not to shove it down your throat, but just so that you understand what the basis of this. So last night, Tarek tells me that a bunch of you guys have to go to IOP today, and you're going to miss the first 2 hours of the thing. Last night, I'm like, cool, whatever. No big deal. I'm driving here this morning, and this tape is playing in my head. And I'm like, every mile I travel south, it's like, I can't believe those motherfuckers aren't going to be there. You know, we're going to have an empty room, and I'm going to be wasting my whole day. And it's like, and I'm like sitting there watching my thoughts going, wow, this is fascinating. Last night, I didn't care. This morning, I'm pissed. But I walk in, I tell Tarek, I'm like, dude, like, do we even need to do this thing? Because nobody's going to be here. And Tarek, like, looks at me like, what are you talking about? It's like, IOP. And he's like, we'll have plenty of people. Don't worry about it, dude. And I'm like, apparently I need to write about this. So here it is. So this is an institution, I'm going to say, because it's not anybody specifically. It's IOP, right? Column one, IOP. Column two, takes people away from having a real experience. Okay. Well, some of you get to experience what it's like to have inventory about you read to you. This is kind of fun. Rarely do we get to have a real live example to give you, but this one's real. So self-esteem. Tarek and I are gurus and better than any IOP therapist.
Yeah.
Okay? Wow. This is what goes on up here, right?
Yeah.
Pride. Others should know we have so much more to offer. Ambition. I want these guys to have the same experience as the guys at the Bridges of Hope have. Security. I need the room to be full to feel important so that I can feel okay.
Mm-hmm.
Personal relations. Real recovery residences force their clients to attend workshops. Sex relations. Real men show up. Pocketbook, the time I wasted covering the information that I covered when they were in IOP. Okay? Pocketbook's time and money. Okay? So column four, what am I afraid of? What's really going on here? Because all that stuff I just wrote, that's going on up here, but none of it matters. I'm afraid that I will not be useful and people will think I'm a fraud. Dishonest, I know nothing about their program and why IOP is necessary. I'm selfish because I am only concerned with myself and how this makes me look. No concern for anybody else's welfare whatsoever. Selfish? You bet. Self-seeking? I want them to be different than they're even allowed to be. Okay? So I write this, and it's funny now. The worse I sound when I write the third column, usually the freer I get as a result. I didn't even have to write column four. I rarely have to write column four anymore because I see the insanity that exists in the third column. So if we look down towards the bottom of page 66, it says that we turn back to the list for it held the key to the future. So this is a trick question. When they say that we look back to the list for it held the key to the future, what do you think they mean? Do you think that we turn back to the list for it held the key to the future? Because that's what I think they mean. So this list of people that I have these resentments at, if I actually do this thing honestly and look at it, it gets me free of every single resentment I've ever had. Does that sound like the future?
Yes.
Pretty cool to me. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. That's what I was showing you. Getting in, doing this at a deeper level, that's looking at it from an entirely different angle. Not just a little check mark, oh, my self-esteem's affected, my pride's affected, ambition, security, pocketbook, whatever. Like, I'm looking at it from a deeper level. How does this really impact what goes on in my head? How does this really impact my relationship with you? How does this really impact my relationship with the world? Okay? We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. Now, I do not believe that real exists in this sentence. Because I know from a lot of the work that I do and what I experience that everything in my head is fancied. Everything. I twist and turn everything to my liking in my head to make me look better. And when I'm going to explain it to you, I'm going to make sure that I present it in the best possible way to make me look the most right. So my resentments are always fancied. And they're never real. And knowing that gets me completely free of this crap that I write in the second column. Gets me free of this crap that I write in the third column. And I suspect if when we get to the sixth step and I go through some of my list of defects, you're going to see a lot of this same stuff show up. Because it doesn't just go away. It gets less.
Well, another thing about the key to the future... and I love the fact that you guys got a real, live, breathing resentment that he wrote about. Because inventory is such a powerful tool. It allows us to look at things from an entirely different angle, to see the insanity of that third column. Because had he not done that, who knows how long that would have brewed inside, and it would have begun to build and build and build. But he's totally free of that right now. Because he sees how his trouble is of his own making. So I don't know about any of you, but I do know about me. My entire life before I ever worked a step was I knew who I was angry at. I could describe to you why I was angry at them. And if you asked me how I was affected, I could probably give you a description of that. But I had never, ever, ever set aside entirely what these people had done to me and looked for my own mistakes and where I had been at fault and how I created the situation. So when the big book talks about a psychic change, the first realization I had that something in my personality had changed was when I began to interact with life and I began to get into some troubles or have some struggles, and the first thing I did or I was instructed to do by an elder was, how did you create this situation? How did you create this situation? How's this trouble of your own making? That's the beginning. I think that's like the birth of the psychic change for us. It truly is. Because we are the assigners of blame when we get here. It's everyone else's fault. If it's my fault, it's this much, and you're this much. Right? And so, look, one of the most watered-down pieces of Alcoholics Anonymous is this idea that I have a part. How many times in a meeting do you hear people say, I'm looking for my part? You guys hear that a lot, right? It's not in the big book. Let's see what the big book says. On page 67, it says, referring to our list again, putting out of the minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we disregard the other person entirely. Where are we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man or woman. When we see our faults, we list them, we place them before us in black and white. We admit our wrongs honestly, and we're willing to set these matters straight. Nowhere does it say my part. And let me explain to you why this is an important concept to understand. If I truly think I have a part, and you have a part, whose part do you think I think's bigger?
All right, so here's the whole part, right? Here is the whole part. What percentage is Tarek going to take, do you think?
Smallest
piece. Here you go. Here's your part. Here's your part, guys.
Yeah.
Right?
Smallest piece possible.
Yeah.
That's what we do.
So what do you think happens when you go make amends to this person and you're there to clean up your part? Well, naturally, they're going to want to
clean up
their part,
too. I'm really sorry about this part, but okay, now you go.
And that's where we get in trouble with amends, where we think just because someone wronged us that they were going to have to make amends to us. I've made amends to some people that wronged me much more than I wronged them, and they didn't make amends to me, and I still walked away a free man.
Were these people in the program?
No. No, but I have people. I mean, I'll tell you guys a story. I mean, I caught one of my girlfriends cheating on me. I mean, I caught them in the act. And I made amends to him. I made amends to her when I got sober because of what I did to him after that happened.
Nice.
And it wasn't physical. What I did to him was completely mental. But I made that amends, and he made amends to me. But I could have walked away from him not making amends to me, and I would have been completely free. So we're gonna. Brandon's gonna run through fear and conduct, and you want to do that?
Mm-hmm. I feel compelled to read these little pieces because they make me look really bad too. These are other little pieces of inventory. Fear: if my thoughts, needs, wants, desires are not met, I cannot be happy. Dishonest: because I have little or no. This is all column four. I'm not gonna read you the other stuff because to me it doesn't matter. I'm dishonest because I have little or no faith that when I say he is on his own path, I actually believe it. Instead, I secretly wish everyone will do as I think and be ready to change direction at a moment's notice, even though I know that I have flawed thinking. I'm selfish because I only care about me and what goes on in my head. Self-seeking because I build walls of arrogance and indifference to generate a feeling of superiority simply as a defense mechanism to protect me from what thinking I know is flawed. I have a sense of arrogance that protects me from being truly authentic with anyone I meet. Then I cry that nobody understands me and walk around in self-pity, waiting for the world to change instead of taking the necessary action to improve my life. This one's about an employer. I wrote it about one employer, and then I went to go apply it to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It worked for 6 different employers. I'm afraid that people are justified to fire me and that I am not as cool as I think I am in my head. I'm dishonest because I walk around with arrogance instead of trying to be of service to God's children. I am always trying to find ways to get other people's money. I'm selfish because I have almost no ability to see anyone else in my life. I'm self-seeking because I give minimal effort expecting maximum results. I read inventory to see the insanity of my mind. When the insanity is apparent, I can see the connection to my insane mind I use to make decisions with on a daily basis. If I truly understand that my mind, when insane, I may think a drink looks like a solution instead of a problem. This is why I must continue to write inventory. Write inventory once and be done. I see the connection between the insanity of my thoughts and a drink. It's real clear to me. Because I start to buy my bullshit. I start to buy the stuff that goes on in my head and think that it's actually real. Okay, so...
Hey, that's what we should write.
We'll take a 15-minute break here and come back and hit some more stuff.